I'm Jennifer Westaway in Boston.
I'm Robin Young in New York.
It's Here and Now.
Well, last night, Vice President Dick Cheney and Georgia Senator Zell Miller addressed a Republican delegate, Miller becoming the first from another party to ever deliver a keynote at a national nominating convention. Miller excoriated his fellow Democrats and candidate John Kerry. Earlier today, we spoke with Utah Senator Orrin Hatch. I asked him if he thought Zell Miller went a little too far in his criticism of John Kerry last night, and he said, absolutely not. The party has gone too far to the left. Well, for more on last night's speeches and on what the president will say tonight, we're joined here in our studio at Madison Square Garden by James Coonan. He's national correspondent for the Knight Ridder chain of papers. Thanks so much for coming in, Jim.
Robin, my pleasure.
And first of all, to Zell Miller, we'll get to the president and what he has to say tonight in a moment, but to Zell Miller first, we heard from Orrin Hatch that he didn't go too far. What are you hearing?
He was a great hit on the floor. Got a great deal of applause. But at the same time, there are some members, some delegates, who said he may have been a little over the top. Just talking to Scott Kluge, former member from Wisconsin, House member from Wisconsin, who's a delegate, who said he's a little bit over the top. I think Senator John McCain was quoted as saying that he disagreed with any assertion that Democrats are unpatriotic. So there was a sense that that maybe he was a little bit too much of a scowling face. But at the same time, I think he offered some red meat for delegates.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of what Miller said. Here he's talking about how Kerry would defend the United States.
Senator Kerry has made it clear that he would use military force only if approved by the United Nations. Kerry would let Paris decide when America needs defending. I want Bush to decide.
Well, they loved it inside the hall, but do we have any indication of how it played outside?
Well, there's been the reports of at least one focus group that I'm aware of of undecided voters that determined that Senator Miller did actually quite well, and which is an interesting finding, because it suggests that maybe what undecided voters want is a little bit of certitude, some facts that they can wrap their minds around. And what Senator Miller did do is he listed a defense program after defense program that Senator Kerry has at some point in his 20-year career in the Senate voted against. And I think that maybe undecided voters don't want ad hominem attacks, but they want some facts that they can consider.
Well, you call them facts. We're going to have Democratic response in a moment, but were they facts?
They are indeed facts, but facts, they're facts and then they're facts. Or as somebody said, they're facts and then there's truth. He has had a 20-year career in the Senate. During that time, he has had an opportunity to vote on a number of budgets proposed both by Republican and Democratic presidents. In this case, these were budgets proposed then by President Reagan. In fact, in 2002, he voted for what was arguably the largest increase in defense spending since the 1980s. At the same time, Democrats will be quick to point out, and rightfully, that Vice President Cheney, when he was Secretary of Defense for the former President Bush, proposed some of these same program cuts in order to satisfy some reductions in the Pentagon budget when the country was in some high deficits.
Well, let's talk about Vice President Cheney in the minute or so we have left. You also say that one of the attempts last night might have been to make him look soft in comparison to Miller.
Well, I think if not the calculated plan of the party, it certainly may have ended up looking that way. I mean, Senator Miller looked basically like Cotton Mather up there, just very, very tense, scowling. Not a single smile came from his lips. When Vice President Cheney spoke, he was more avuncular. He was the uncle that you could cuddle up with. Mm. And so as a result, if he was able to shed that image of him being scary, that worked for him.
Well, you mentioned, we're talking about Cheney, and one of the questions floating around today is, Where was Mary Cheney on the stage last night? She was in the family box watching the speech, but when the whole family came out, she wasn't there. Mary Cheney, of course, the lesbian daughter of Dick Cheney. We asked Liz Cheney, the sister, who came out with her children last night. We asked her earlier this week if Mary was going to be there. She said, oh, sure, front and center. She wasn't.
Fascinating question, and we're trying to find that out as well. She was, as you said, she was in the box. She wasn't dissing the whole party here. But as you said, this has been this issue of gay rights has been lingering beneath the surface. It has been a divisive issue with Republicans, and we don't know if she was trying to make a statement by her lack of appearance. But in any event, it remains an open question.
It raises a question. Yeah. James Coonan, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thanks,
Jim. Jim is national correspondent for Knight Ridder.
As we've heard, Dick Cheney and Zell Miller repeatedly questioned John Kerry's fitness to be commander-in-chief last night. For a Democrat's response, we go to retired four-star general Tony McPeak. He backed Bob Dole in 1996 and George Bush in 2000. Today, he's with the Kerry campaign. General McPeak, welcome.
Although he voted to authorize...
Thank you, Jennifer.
Let's get right to some specifics. In the speeches last night, Dick Cheney and Zell Miller both say that John Kerry opposed Ronald Reagan's defense buildup, the buildup that they say won the Cold War. Is that an accurate accusation?
You know, if you spend 20 years in the Senate, you get to vote on the motion to table something, the amendment to the amendment to the amendment, and so forth. So if you want to go back over 20 years' worth of voting, I'm sure in there Zell Miller can pick out the vote that he wants against some specific weapon system. But that's not the issue and shouldn't be the issue in this campaign.
Dick Cheney also said that Senator Kerry, the quote here, he ridiculed the senator for promising to lead a more sensitive war on terror. Out of context?
Yeah, I expect it is out of context. And not even the president's best friends would accuse him of knowing anything about syntax. He's said that he's never made a mistake in this war in Iraq, but now we find out he's miscalculated, that it's been a catastrophic success. A couple of days ago, he said he cannot win the war on terrorism. He had his handlers pulling their hair out over that one, so now he's reversed course and says, oh, yeah, he's winning it and can win it.
I'd like to get back to the accusations that were made against the senator. There was another comment made that he voted against body armor, fuel, spare parts, armored vehicles, extra pay for people in the military.
Yeah, look, Jennifer, that particular vote was on a defense supplemental appropriations bill that the White House threatened to veto. You have to be inside the Beltway and know whether you're voting on the amendment to amend and all the rest of that nonsense. Does anybody think that John Kerry is against issuing body armor to our guys in combat? Please hold your hand up out there. That makes no sense whatsoever. It's just another example of throwing mud into the game instead of debating the real issues.
And is this another example when we move to Zell Miller's speech, because he highlighted a series of military hardware, B-1 bombers, F-14 fighter jet, Patriot missile, that he says John Kerry voted against in the Senate?
Look, I spent my working lifetime handling Air Force appropriations. I'm intimately familiar with the B-1 bomber and the B-2 bomber that Dick Cheney canceled and so forth. So all of this is nonsense.
One of the comments in the speech as well was that Kerry would use military force only if approved by the United Nations. Is that true?
Come on, Jennifer.
I didn't say it. It's in the speech. I'm asking for a response.
Okay, my response is that is baloney. And like so much of the rest of this baloney, they try to wrap it in the flag. But you know what? If you take baloney and wrap it in a flag, it's still baloney. But now you've insulted the flag, and that kind of irritates me.
General, thank you for speaking with us today.
Okay, my dear.
Retired Air Force General Tony McPeak is with the Kerry campaign. As Hurricane Frances heads for Florida, more than a million people are evacuating areas along the coast. The storm comes 3 weeks after Hurricane Charley ripped into Florida. Hurricane Frances is just as strong and twice as big. Joining us on the line is Susanna Neesmith. She's a reporter for the Miami Herald. She joins us from Miami. Welcome, Susanna.
Thank you.
What's the big worry with Francis?
Well, there are a lot of big worries with a storm this large. There's concern that it could push a storm surge of water into the coastal areas, pushing the ocean or bays ahead of it. There are concerns with the winds that it will bring and the rain that it will bring.
Now, 750,000 people ordered to evacuate. I imagine a few more have decided for themselves to leave. Where have they all gone?
Well, that is one of the issues. Actually, emergency managers at this point are asking people who are not in the evacuation zone to stay put because of concerns that they will congest the shelters and the highways.
So even if you feel like you want to get out for your own safety, they'd rather not clog up the roads?
Well, they are telling people that, you know, if you have a medical condition, if you have, for some reason, you feel like you have to get out, then go ahead. But for folks that their house is not in a flood zone, they really should probably stay put.
What kind of preparations are being made in addition to evacuating people from the expected worst-hit areas?
Well, at this point, you know, the lines are around the block at all the hardware stores. People are stocking up on water, on batteries, on candles. A lot of the people here in South Florida came through Hurricane Andrew, and they know that it may be days. We spoke to one woman yesterday who recalled drinking the water out of her fish tank.
I thought you were going to say toilet there for a minute.
That has happened, too. And I can't imagine your fish water tastes very good. So people are really stocking up this time. And the state also just came through Charlie. We saw during Charlie that though the projected path we thought was going to hit Tampa, it turned south very quickly, right at the last minute. So people here know and are aware that even if at the moment they're saying it's going to hit Palm Beach, down here in Dade County, we need to be ready.
Well, speaking of Charlie, that was only a little over 3 weeks ago. Has that impaired in any way state officials' ability to prepare for Hurricane Francis?
The state folks are saying no, that they're ready. There are local folks who were hit by Charlie are concerned. There's still a lot of homes that are wrapped in tarps, with tarps over their roofs, and there's still plenty of debris. I spoke with folks in Port Charlotte this morning, and they are concerned about debris that's still around that could be whipped up in a storm. The storm is large enough that they're expecting that it'll go all the way across the state. Though it's coming from a different direction from Charlie, a lot of the same people may be hit again.
And are in a particularly fragile state to meet it. What's the mood like? How are the people of Florida getting ready to batten down the hatches?
People are scared. The hurricane managers are taking the storm very seriously and have been warning people for a couple days now that this is a big, frightening storm. And people are taking it very seriously. Like I said, there are lines at all the hardware stores. Cash machines are running out of money. Gasoline pumps are running out of gas, and there are lines at the gas pumps. People are getting ready and getting worried.
Thank you for joining us today, Susanna.
Thank you.
Susanna Neesmith is a reporter with the Miami Herald.
Just ahead, we'll speak to Ronald Reagan's chief political strategist to find out what the great communicator would say tonight.
And later in the show, Zell isn't the only Miller who's supporting George Bush. We'll hear from comedian and former Democrat Dennis Miller.
There's more coming up from the Republican convention here and now.
I'm Jennifer Westaway in Boston.
I'm Robin Young at the Republican National Convention in New York. It's here and now.
Sometimes a political campaign comes down to a single sentence. The catchphrase in 1980 was Ronald Reagan's, "Are you better off now than you were 4 years ago?" One of the men who wrote that line for Reagan was his chief strategist and pollster, Dick Werthlin. He's co-author of a coming book on Ronald Reagan called The Great Communicator. He joins us from New York City to talk about the communicators of Campaign 2004. Dick Werthlin, welcome.
It's good to be here.
Is there a catchphrase for this campaign so far, do you think?
I think there is, Jennifer. One of the strategies that we've found to be so effective is to set the question in the mind of the soft or undecided voter before he or she goes to the ballot booth. This year, I think the question is different, but the strategic frame is very much the same. And that is, will you and your family be more safe and secure 4 years from now if John Kerry is elected the president.
Yeah. You write a lot in your book about what made Ronald Reagan such a great communicator, and neither candidate in this campaign is known as someone who excels at this. And I'm wondering if we can start with George Bush. Walk us through what President Bush gets right and what needs work in his communication skills.
Well, I think there are two things. One, I do think he projects an image of strength, both physically and in the rhetoric and the way that's delivered. Mm-hmm. I believe his biggest weakness, however, is he is somewhat stiff, not only reflects in what he says and how he says it, but even, for instance, how he walks.
Mm-hmm.
He walks almost has an arrogant stride. And I think he would take a page from Reagan's book if, in fact, he could be a little softer but not soften his message.
It's interesting that you use the word stiff, because that's so often a word ascribed to John Kerry. How do you view him?
I believe that John Kerry is even more accurately described as stiff and austere. Ultimately, the vote hinges to a large extent on trust and who people can extend the future of the nation to for the next 4 years. There has to be an emotional component that drives the vote.
There's some sort of connection with the voter there.
And absolutely.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, given some of the speeches this week, whether you think that Arnold Schwarzenegger might be the natural heir to the mantle of great communicator.
Well, for me, watching the governor was quite a revelation, in the sense that he does combine both reason and tapping into people's values. I also think that making this connection person to person can be greatly enhanced through humor.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be interesting to see what George Bush does tonight. And I think that you may see someone who is firm, someone who can be trusted. But also, I'm hoping that this speech will also have an overtone of humanity and caring, because ultimately that is the other side of strength, and American voters like to see both sides, strength and caring.
On that note, you did write in the book about a very moving episode in Ronald Reagan's life as president, a story about a phone encounter he had with quite an angry relative of a deceased soldier. And this is in some way something that's come up for President George Bush in the Iraq War, with his decision not to attend funerals of soldiers killed in Iraq. Tell us what Ronald Reagan did.
Well, the person who called somehow thought he was talking to a program director of one of the major television network. Now, how he got into the White House and how he got into the Oval Office with his phone call.
Wow.
Being a good communicator to a large extent is being a good listener. And I happened to be in the Oval Office when that call almost by mistake came through. And rather than immediately cutting him off and said, "You're speaking to the President of the United States, this is Ronald Reagan," Ronald Reagan let the man vent his anger, and then at the end told him that he was talking to the president, and the president extended his concern. The man was profusely apologetic about the call.
Mm-hmm. When we look at this campaign in 2004 and look ahead a bit to the fall, of course, the debates are looming. What kind of advice would you have for George Bush and John Kerry heading into those debates?
Well, I think the advice would be that voters, again, make up their mind on the whole package. It isn't the words. It's also the image that is conveyed. And again, going back to what I think the turnkey question with Bush, the issue hinges on what has been done to date. Is Iraq is fighting terrorism? Are these perceptual assets in terms of the emotional component of being safe and secure? On the contrary, of course, John Kerry has to understand that the closest cousin to strength is consistency, and voters reject candidates who waffle.
Dick Wortham, thank you for joining us today.
Well, it's my pleasure, and it's good to be on your program.
Dick Wortham, chief strategist and pollster for Ronald Reagan, is co-author of The Greatest Communicator, which comes out later this month.
Tomorrow in Here and Now, we head off to two of the swing states to see how this week's Republican convention played with undecideds.
And remember those film strips from way back when in elementary school? Now there's a collection of them. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. More ahead Here and Now.
I'm Jennifer Westaway in Boston.
I'm Robin Young at Madison Square Garden.
It's Here and Now.
One of the topics of discussion away from the podium here at the RNC is what's going on with the neoconservatives, that group that includes members of the Bush administration, scholars, and scribes, who strongly pushed for regime change in Iraq as a way to change the region and eradicate terrorism. The neocon point of view is laid out in the Weekly Standard magazine, edited by Bill Kristol, and said to be a favorite of Vice President Dick Cheney. And you can hear the neocon strain of the Republican Party in Cheney's speech last night.
Even in this post-9/11 period, Senator Kerry doesn't appear to understand how the world has changed. He talks about leading a more sensitive war on terror, as though al-Qaeda will be impressed with our softer side.
But recently, there have been fractures in the neocons' strong wall of support for the war. The New York Times reported that scholar and author Francis Fukuyama reversed his position after hearing a speech by his good friend and fellow neocon, Charles Krauthammer, which Fukuyama called strangely disconnected from reality. Krauthammer is a columnist for The Washington Post and contributor to The Weekly Standard. We met up with him at the Standard's office here in the Garden and asked him to respond to Fukuyama, who said he had private doubts about the war, and it turned out to be worse than he expected, that Mr. Krauthammer and others were overconfident about turning Iraq into a democracy, too quick to dismiss allies, and that they mischaracterized Iraq and Islamic radicals as an immediate threat to the U.S.
Oh, that's really post facto rationalization. Nobody of any seriousness underestimated how difficult and dangerous and risky Iraq would be. I wrote that myself many times.
When we came here, you said, oh, you want to do that New York Times thing. What do you think his concern indicates? What's going on?
Well, the centerpiece of my argument is that with 9/11, we have, in a sense, re-entered history. The 60 years of existential struggle we had experienced between the 30s and the 90s with Nazism and communism, which we imagine had come to an end with the collapse of the Soviet Union, was encapsulated by Fukuyama in the article that sort of made his fame, an article called The End of History. The centerpiece of my argument is that 9/11 marks a return to history, as a return to existential struggle, confrontation with an enemy who wants to destroy you. He argues that because al-Qaeda does not, in the words he used, currently possess the means to carry out an existential attack on the United States, it's not an existential enemy. And my counterargument is that that's precisely the situation Hitler was in 1936 when he occupied the Rhineland. He did not currently, at that time, have the means to overrun Europe, but he was surely an existential threat. So the absence currently does not in any way vitiate the claim that it is an existential threat. And I think it's important for a person like Fukuyama to deny this centrality of the threat because he's very deeply personally invested in the idea that history ended, that in fact his thesis that history had ended turns out to be rather mistaken, rather glaringly so.
But do you think there's anything bigger going on here? People are seeing this as a real schism in the neoconservative movement.
Well, I addressed that in my piece. The fact is, people imagine that neoconservatism is a club that meets on Wednesdays in one room, and we all agree.
It doesn't?
No, and we have party line, and we have marching orders and talking the points, which, of course, all pass through Rupert Murdoch. It's not quite that way. There actually has been a long-existing split among neoconservatives, and it has to do with the fact that there are two schools of neoconservatism. One is realist, and the other is more idealist. And to give you a very concrete example of what that means, in the late 90s, there was a debate in America about whether to intervene in the Balkans. The neoconservatives were not at all unanimous on this. They were split down the middle. Some were in favor of intervention. They were people like Bill Kristol, writers who are sort of known as the idealists among the neoconservatives, the ones who want to spread democracy everywhere. And then there were the realists, people like myself, Henry Kissinger, who argue that we do not have an obligation to go to war, to intervene everywhere, to spread democracy. A kind of a dry powder theory of intervention. You keep your powder dry in conflicts which are not deeply necessary for your national security, as the Balkans were not strategically necessary, in order to be ready with your powder dry if and when a real strategic existential enemy arises, which is precisely what happened on 9/11. And the discovery of these two schools by the New York Times is commendable, a form of investigative reporting which unfortunately is about 15 years too late and after the fact.
Well, Charles, as you know, others have reversed their support for the war. Conservative columnist David Brooks made an apology. He wrote the Iraq War was a mistake, a total nightmare, a disaster. He was ashamed of his support for it.
Look, you look at the world the way you see it, and you have to decide whether or not you think that Iraq was necessary, whether Iraq is still doable, and whether there's any alternative policy. My answers to the three of those are what they were a year ago.
What do you say to people who say ideology blinded the neocons? Ahmed Chalabi, for instance, he was the darling of the architects of the war. We now know he passed on bad information.
Well, first of all, I never met him. I never wrote about him. I never supported him. The question as to whether we're blinded by ideology, I think ideology is absolutely necessary if you're going to have a serious approach to the world. Ideology means a connected set of ideas grounded in assumptions about human nature and about how states act in the world. It's like saying in the Cold War, the way to deal with it is to hunt communists in America and the West and eliminate them. It wasn't. The way to do it was to change and restructure the source of the problem, which was Russia under communism.
But we didn't have to invade the Soviet Union.
Well, the Soviet Union was containable. If I thought that al-Qaeda was containable and deterrable, I would also argue for a containment strategy.
But al-Qaeda is not Iraq.
No, al-Qaeda is not Iraq. Al-Qaeda is a sort of the ultimate extension of the disorder in the Arab world. It took 70 years for communism to wither and die. If you think that we can wait 70 years for the Arab world to reform itself, I think that's a bad idea. I think that between now and 2074, we're likely to suffer a few Hiroshimas in the United States. Therefore, I think we have to have a different approach.
Any soul-searching here at the Weekly Standard?
No.
Weekly Standard contributor and neoconservative Charles Krauthammer.
Still to come, comedian Dennis Miller on why he's no longer a Democrat.
You're listening to Here and Now. Well, President Bush has come to Madison Square Garden. He's tested the microphones on the floor and pronounced them perfect. Word is that he's going to be giving sort of an Oprah-like delivery of his speech tonight in sort of a round setting, stage on the ground right in the middle of the delegates. And in this fight over the red and blue states, that is, this presidential election is more focused than ever on the shades in between, the undecided, some call them purple states, where the race is still up for grabs. WBUR's Audie Cornish has been talking to swing state delegates. She joins us now with their take on last night's speeches. Audie, I know you're right there on the floor with them. What did they say?
Well, when it came to Zell Miller, a lot of the delegates I spoke to seemed to consider him sort of in totality with or in context with the rest of the program. And so following that logic, it's he's a Democrat, a longtime Democrat, who has sort of seen the light. That's one phrase I heard more than once. The idea that Zell Miller is someone who has looked at both sides of this issue or has looked at many of the ideas, especially around foreign policy, and decided that the Republican Party has the solution. And they really appreciated him coming out and really talking about Kerry and Kerry's record.
Were they surprised?
They were not surprised at all. In fact,
he's been all over.
He has been. Yeah. And frankly, a lot of the delegates said they were happy that finally their party was coming out and saying things directly about Kerry's Senate record, which they felt that the Democrats ignored during their convention, and that they feel the conversation is getting bogged down in the idea of his Vietnam record. And so they appreciated the role that Miller played. They appreciated the comments that Vice President Dick Cheney made.
Well, and we should say that other delegates and John McCain felt that Zell Miller went over the top. But I'm wondering, are they saying that he's giving them and others are giving them the ammunition they need to go home and sway voters?
Well, not necessarily him. A lot of the delegates did think that that overall the convention had a positive tone that they wanted to keep. If anything, they looked at Miller. Obviously, he's already a Democrat. They looked at him as a bit of an anomaly in going so far. But they're going home feeling energized about the base. And here's Jeannie McIntyre from Florida.
I think the independent voter, to show them that the president has a vision, he's consistent, he doesn't waver, he's a man who, like the vice president said, has a backbone of steel. He's a man who is the same on Saturday night as he is on Sunday morning.
And so here's the idea that the vice president and other people who have spoken during this week are showcasing the party and the president's consistency. This was a very important theme to people from hotly contested states. They also had very high praise for the way, again, the entire program has been executed using speakers Laura Bush and Arnold Schwarzenegger and Giuliani. Here's Bill Pettigrew from Pennsylvania.
I think while they're watching it, maybe thinking that they're going to hate these people and not like Republicans, they're going to find out, you know what, we got to keep this nation safe. We have to keep this nation on the right message economically. And I think we're going to get a lot of people that are just coming over to our side just by this convention alone. We just have to reassure that message and over the next 2 months make sure that we stay on course.
So delegates from hotly contested states are going home completely fired up and are showing this to their home state.
Yeah, this is a rally because we hear it. Some of them have been asked to go and get 30 more voters each. So off they go after tomorrow. Thank you, Audie Cornish.
Thank you.
WBUR's Audie Cornish. And stay with us. Dennis Miller is ahead here and now.
I'm Jennifer Westaway in Boston.
I'm Robin Young at Republican National Convention in New York.
It's Here and Now.
Security at the RNC is, of course, very tight. So how is it that protesters have twice been able to get within feet of Vice President Dick Cheney? And yesterday, White House Chief of Staff Andrew Card's speech was disrupted by between 5 and 10 ACT UP demonstrators. Well, one possible answer comes from a colleague in the next booth here at Radio Row, Air America's Dan Pashman, editorial producer for the show Morning Sedition, and he joins us now. Dan, I understand that you were able to get right under the stage here at Madison Square Garden, a restricted space. How did that happen?
Well, I met a gentleman here who I befriended, works here at Madison Square Garden, who's a friend of the cause, so to speak, and he
shall remain nameless.
Right, he shall remain nameless, exactly. And he said, "Hey, why don't you come down and see what it looks like underneath the stage?" And I said, "Hey, this sounds pretty interesting." At that point, didn't even realize that it was a restricted area until I ended up down there and realized that I was directly under the stage, within arm's reach of the podium, moments after Laura Bush had finished speaking.
Let's listen to your tape.
All right, we are underneath the stage here. So, hypothetically, if somebody wanted to cut out George W. Bush's teleprompter right as he begins his speech, is this where you'd want to be to do that?
I'm not even sure where that would be. This is mostly audio.
So to cut out his mic, this is where I'd want to be?
Yeah, you could do that.
I could cut out his mic from down here?
Room over there.
Bulletproof room back there. That thing there says, do not touch. What's that?
What's that? That's for this lift here, for the toaster. And the podium. The podium's come out of the deck also.
So we're directly beneath the podium?
Yeah, that's the podium right here.
That is the podium. The main podium is right there. We are directly underneath it at this time.
You know there's no media in this part of the floor? Do you guys know that?
I did not.
Mm-mm. No media on the fifth floor. In the OP.
Okay.
No go.
Okay, we'll head out then.
Please.
So obviously you were finally removed. You mentioned there was a cause. You are, you know, the uber liberal station here, and do have an agenda, right?
Yes, that's fair to say.
So having divulged that, what other observations did you make on the floor?
Well, it was my first time on the at the convention. I was a bit surprised by how subdued it was, and I saw these signs. I think that I was kind of surprised by, struck by, that said "Let freedom reign." As we all know, the sign, the song says "Let freedom ring." And
from every mountainside.
Exactly. And when I hear the word rain, I think of a monarchy or a dictatorship.
Dan Pashman, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Morning's Edition producer Dan Pashman. That show is heard on the radio network Air America. Well, comedian Dennis Miller, he of the multisyllabic vocabulary and the steel trap mind for Arcana, now hosts a cable show on CNBC. He was once the Weekend Update anchor on Saturday Night Live. He was also once a Democrat. Yesterday, we spoke to Dennis from Burbank, California, and we asked this newly minted Republican how his team is doing.
Well, obviously, if you've watched last night with Arnold, by the way, very infrequently do you hear somebody say that Richard Nixon brought them to the dinner party. And then I watched Kerry today speaking before the veterans, and he just looked deflated, quite frankly. I would say the wind has gone out of the windsurfing sail on Mr. Kerry. I think that the RNC is having a great convention so far.
Well, you know, some people would say Dennis Miller, the Dennis Miller we know, would be having a field day with this, and Arnold Schwarzenegger calling economists girly men, constant camera shots of the very few minorities in the hall. What have you been saying on your show? And forgive us, we're hermetically sealed here. We haven't been able to catch
anything.
Well,
as the election gets closer, I am reticent to go after the president, in much the same way I assume NPR is reticent to go after John Kerry. We both know where the lines are drawn in this discussion.
Oh, no.
Here's the first, Robin Young of NPR telling us that she's coming out for Bush right on the air. I love that. Good for you,
Kudo.
I know you're going to catch some hell in that shop, but I admire you for stepping up to the plate and voicing that you are going for George Bush this November.
The point is, you'll never know what I think, but we're supposed to know what you think.
I thought you were just advocating him.
But wait, we're supposed to know what you think. Are you really not going to do political commentary? The world will come to an end.
No, I want Bush to be my president, so I'm going to make jokes about Kerry between now and then.
And what? And like what?
Well, there's two types of politicians. There's chess players and checkers players. Now, I look at Kerry, and he's a chess player. He examines every permutation, every possible move, but in the dangerous times we live, the egg timer can go off, and you miss your move. Bush is a checkers player. Occasionally, he runs across the jag off, and he jumps him, and that's why I'm voting for him.
Yeah, and when did this all happen? Remind us.
9/11. I think half the country seems to be in a complete coma. 9/11 was the biggest wake-up call that we'll receive unless we receive a dirty bomb one down the road. We are at war. George Bush understands that. I think that some on the left are conflicted about that. I'm not. I'm voting for Bush.
Well, Dennis, a lot of people were with President Bush after 9/11, but moved away after the Iraq War because they feel that that has, in fact, taken us away from the real target of the war on terror.
Yeah,
when was the last time you heard President Bush say Osama bin Laden?
Where is that war on terrorism located, Robin? Give me the longitude and latitude on the country of Al-Qaeda. I want to know. I don't know the firm geographic demarcations of that country. Saddam Hussein was an expediter. He was like the guard in the middle of the fast break who would pass the ball off. And you know something? It was as good a place to start as any. We'll find Osama bin Laden. How's that? I think that there are better ways to spend their 4 days than going up and saying, we apologize, we haven't found Osama bin Laden. John Kerry would have because he was in Vietnam. I don't know. That all seems like crazy tactics to me. That seems like you're picking around the fringes. And you know something? I hope that liberals continue to do that right up until November 2nd because I guarantee you they're going to get exactly what they hate, which is 4 more years of George Bush. I look forward to it. But you guys can nibble at his semantics or his malaprops. You can say, oh, he said we can't win the war. You can talk about all that stuff. It's not playing out here. And I think you can sense that too. The wind has gone out of this Kerry thing, and somebody over there better take a stand on something or your guy's going to get whomped.
He's not my guy. Dennis, you should have heard me at the Democratic convention. But you mentioned out there, you are right now in California, in Los Angeles, outside Los Angeles. And I'm wondering, you know, what is that like to be one of the few conservative voices in the comic community? I mean, what happens there?
I could care less, God. You know, I never follow the conventional wisdom in Hollywood. I remember when Hollywood was telling me Yahoo Serious was the next great screen comic. So I take it with a grain of salt. I don't care what people think about me. I'm a 50-year-old man with 2 kids. I got to start worrying about the world. I could care less what parties I'm invited to or not.
By the way, you mentioned liberals. Al Franken, host of the Very Liberal Air America Network, is just about 5 feet from me. Anything you want to say to him?
Yeah, Al's one of my best friends from Saturday Night Live. I care for him deeply. I couldn't disagree with him more, but I think it points out that we have gotten so crazy about this D and R after people's names in this culture that we're actually, like, doing away with friendships over it and stuff like that. Al and I do not agree on things politically. That being said, he's one of the best family men I've ever met. He was my boss at Saturday Night Live. He's a great comedian. And I'm proud to be his friend.
You have said, and I just want to touch on this. You've said that if John Kerry does win, you'll support him.
Yeah, sure I will.
Because?
Because the country's crazy right now and how much we hate the guy on the other side. I hate the terrorists. Now listen, I think Bush will be exponentially better at dealing with terrorism than Kerry will. That being said, if my country decides in early November that it's John Kerry, I'm getting behind him because I'm getting sick of everybody being on the side of punks like Chirac and Schroeder and trying to figure out what the UN's going to do. I'll be behind my guy, and I'm going to shut up about it because terrorism's too important an issue. All these jokes that people want you to do about things, yeah, that's all fine when you're not at war with a bunch of fanatics who believe they go to heaven and get laid if they kill you. Right now, we're in a war, and if we're not going to go sling blade on these people, somebody should tell me because I'm going to go live in Alec Baldwinia.
Dennis Miller, a pleasure.
All right, thank you. And Robin, for you to come out so bravely for President Bush on NPR, I cannot tell you, I'm going to start listening more.
Dennis, thank you.
All right, I got to go. Joan Crock's going to give me $50 million here. I got to split. Bye-bye.
Bye. CNBC talk show host Dennis Miller.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jennifer Westaway.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.